Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, weekday mornings at 6 a.m. on London DAB Digital Radio and on demand via the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com.
Joining us now to discuss is Nari Woods, who is the founding dean of the Blavatnik School of Government and professor of global economic governance at the University of Oxford, and a well-known voice in terms of research into globalization and the economic impact. Nari, welcome to the programme. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. On what is an enormous subject, I mean, we're in a new world economically. We're at the end of cheap money. Politically, though, one could say we're also in a new phase. It's the end of the Kissinger era, the US opening up towards China. That surely is over. What's your big thought on the state of globalization now?
I do think you're right that there's a coming nationalism, which we can see in both the United States and in China. China refers to it as self-reliance, America as protecting American workers, you know, making America great again, and so forth. To me, what it highlights is that globalization was only made possible when governments made a compact with their people that they would protect their people from the vicissitudes of the international economy, and at the same time as they opened up to it. So the 1940s, 50s, 60s, if you like, the kind of golden era of opening up whilst remaining stable and growing, was accompanied by some pretty strong kind of welfare policies at home. Once they began to crumble, the consensus supporting that opening up began to crumble. And that's where we are today, where we're looking at a world of governments whose peoples and voters in democracies are not prepared to support a globalization unless it has some supports and some security for people at home.
Okay. So if we had a stronger NHS in the UK, if we had a significantly higher minimum wage, if corporations paid even better wages, would that solve the issue?
Well, I think, you know, I think some of those things, the very first thing is for governments to show that they are actually on the side of most working people. And that sense has been lost. And we're seeing election after election as a kind of cri de coeur. You know, we want something different. We want something transformative. So I think you're right that those measures, you know, ensuring that people believe that if they work really hard, they will be able to improve their own lives and the possibilities for their children's lives is a really basic proposition. Mm. It's just not the case at the moment in the United States or in Britain that if people work really hard, you know, a majority of people, that they will make lives better for their children. At the moment, a majority of people, when we look at survey evidence, think that simply is no longer true. So they don't have the same stake in the status quo, and the status quo they see as globalization.
And that's something clearly that former President Trump tried to profit from politically. That's the societal element. There's also the national security element, the concern about the fragility of our supply chains, the concern about over-reliance, and of course thrown into underscored really by what's happening with Russia and that overdependence on Russian gas. And clearly there's a read through and there's a lesson to be learned, many would argue, when it comes to our over-reliance, some have described as our over-reliance on China. So talk to us about the national security element and the supply chain element and how different governments can navigate those changes.
That's a huge shift, and it comes on the back of the COVID shift. So COVID highlighted to governments that they didn't have access to supplies which they could control. And so began a debate about friendshoring and ensuring that you either had national sources of supply or very close and security allied sources of supply. And Russia's invasion of Ukraine has doubled down on that and made people intensely aware of not just where their PPE supplies come from or their vaccine supplies, but where does their energy supply come from? And that's led to a real hardening of the security imperatives and their overlaying of economic policy across countries, where the question isn't what's our cheapest supply, but it's what's our most secure supply.
Yeah, so the question has sort of changed. And one wonders whether the question has changed also for voters in the sense that, you know, the idea of common prosperity has an appeal, doesn't it? And China in some ways is offering that to people. I mean, what did you make of Xi Jinping's G20 appearance, for example, not being rebuffed as Vladimir Putin is being, but actually engaging, so much so that there was a kind of off-the-cuff rebuke to Canada's Prime Minister from Xi Jinping, and also that there is an appeal in some ways to common prosperity. That's answering the question that democracies aren't at the moment in some ways.
So a decade ago after the global, more than a decade ago after the global financial crisis, when the G20 leaders group was first formed, the world relied on China to as an engine of growth after the financial crisis. And China did a huge amount to stimulate growth in its own economy, property, infrastructure, urbanization. The problem for the world is that the stringent COVID measures in China and the as well as the other global economic slowdown has meant that Chinese growth has dropped dramatically. And that gives the government of China fewer resources to keep spending in sustaining its growth. And that leads a Chinese government to some pretty brutal choices, because they've been closing down and introducing regulatory measures which are causing foreign investors to step back and step out. So if they're going to keep investing in growth, they're either going to have to attract back some of the foreign investment that they've had, or they're going to have to stimulate completely on their own and tell their people a story as to why they're unable to deliver growth. And that story, if they fail to generate growth, is necessarily going to be a more and more nationalist one. Because you've got to rally people, either by delivering the goods to them or by crafting a nationalist narrative which brings them together in the face of a foreign foe. And I worry that in both the United States and in China, we're seeing that same equation. Either government has to deliver growth, or a story which says that your security relies on this government and on a kind of on a quite exclusive, aggressive nationalism.
Professor, on the challenges around China and its growth prospects, the other hurdle thrown in its way are the restrictions from the United States around technology, specifically semiconductors, chips. How is China likely to adapt to that? And what are the challenges for Brussels, European nations that are under pressure from Washington to take a similarly hard line? And it's clear that the Chancellor of Germany and the President of France are not on board with that. Is there a naivety within Brussels?
Well, so first, between the United States and China, it's game on in a race for which country can, on its own territories, produce the highest grade of chips. And the chips war has become a real element of international security, because both of them are relying so heavily on Taiwan, which, you know, because of the one China policy across the rest of the world, is actually legally a part of China, to which the United States has security obligations. So it's become a real security issue. And at the moment, neither the United States nor China is capable of producing the highest end of chips on its own. Both are engaged in an absolute race to see which one of them can catch up and overtake the other. For Europe, it's incredibly uncomfortable space, because actually Europe does produce chips, but Europe is not in the technology race. It doesn't have a company in the top 10 technology companies racing for dominance of cutting-edge technologies. So Europe has to play a game where, you know, either it joins one camp or the other unconditionally, which gives it absolutely no room for bargaining. So the choice, which for some people might look obvious, that a European Union joins the United States unconditionally, is not obvious in an era where America's own nationalism has become so much part of the political competition. Because we saw during Trump's presidency that an American government that was prepared to slap huge trade tariffs even on its closest allies. Yeah. So Europe has to navigate this incredibly carefully to ensure that it retains some autonomy. And that's why Europe is trying to push a concept of open strategic autonomy, where it develops its own capacity so it retains some choices and doesn't have to unconditionally join an alliance with one or the other.
And to all of this, I want to throw in the UK, Nari. There's a very interesting editorial piece that we have on the terminal this morning about how the UK needs a new European Union deal. You know, we've had such instability in government this year. How does Rishi Sunak now handle this? The UK's in recession. These are major questions for the future of the world and for the UK that's now kind of a satellite to Europe, not part of the EU. What would you be your thinking solution for the current Prime Minister?
You know, coming out of the European Union and, you know, was always going to require exquisite deft footwork by a British government. And sadly, that's not been possible, not just because COVID, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but because of machinations within the Conservative Party itself, which has meant that they have not been able to deliver and provide a stable government. There are departments in the British government that have seen half a dozen ministers in short order, each one of them bringing a new and different vision on how they think policy should be taken forward. And creating just a lot of paralysis and chaos at the same time. So instead of the deft footwork, we've seen a lot of confusion. And that's really existential for Britain now, because even if Britain were able overnight to conclude trade agreements with India, New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, for example, until now, Britain's trade with those four countries has been quite a lot less than its trade just with the Netherlands in the European Union. So what British firms are finding is they've lost access to the markets on which they have carefully built relationships over the last 50 or 60 years. They've lost that access now because of the hard Brexit. And they need now to find other markets. And that's very difficult because the whole rest of the world is trying to do the same. So just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Singapore with the heads of German business, who were in Singapore very proactively forging relations with ASEAN economies so that they can diversify. They want to keep their relationships with China, but they want rapidly to diversify, hugely to increase their trade with Vietnam, with Indonesia, with Singapore, Malaysia, the Philippines, so that they're less reliant exclusively on China for all that they're doing. When I see that kind of proactive strategy and Olaf Scholz and both the Chancellor of Germany and the Vice Chancellor of Germany were right there, you know, in those negotiations, you know, this is what Britain needs to be doing, but it needs to be doing it hugely more than Germany, because Germany has as its backstop the whole of the European Union, to which it has open trade access. The problem for Britain is it's not just about accessing those markets, it's that our whole economy has been shaped, and business and our services industries have been shaped over the 30, 40, 50 years based on an assumption that you can trade with our near partners.
Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, weekday mornings at 6 a.m. on London DAB Digital Radio and on demand via the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com.